If your knees check the weather before you do, time to check out Joint Relief Institute. Fast, FDA-approved pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Hansberry College Prep's located at the corner of 87th and Aberdeen on Chicago's South Side. It sits as a monument to a member of one of Black Chicago's most prominent families, Lorraine Hansberry. The Chicago native made history when her play, A Raisin in the Sun, became the first production by a Black woman to ever premiere on Broadway. And Lorraine's hardly an anomaly. She comes from a long line of high achievers. Her father, Carl, was a real estate developer who was successful in one of the first lawsuits to help push Chicago towards legal integration. But despite the Hansberry's many accomplishments in the city, the family says their relationship with Chicago is extremely complex.
My grandmother had to flee the city of Chicago because the police had surrounded their property. They were planning on, you know, taking her to jail.
That's Tay Hansberry. She's a successful social media influencer based in L.A. Tay is Carl's great-granddaughter and Lorraine's great-niece. For the past several years, she's been trying to raise awareness about what happened to her family during the time that they lived in Chicago. She and I have been talking back and forth for months as I tried to learn more about her story and set up a date for an interview. When we finally picked a day and time to record the segment, I fully expected Tay to join me. What I did know, though, was that Tay had a big surprise for me.
Hi there. I'm Mamie Hansberry, and I'm very delighted that you are talking with us.
Mamie is Tay's grandmother. She's also Carl Hansberry's daughter and Lorraine Hansberry's sister. She's 100 years old and experienced many of the events the family went through while living in Chicago. I wanted to start by getting a better sense of who the Hansberrys were at their core. So I asked Mamie to tell me about our parents, Carl and Nanny Hansberry.
My father was from Mississippi. His family were important community members for that time. And the same with my mother's family from Tennessee. So we carried on the tradition of helping ourselves and helping our community. That was very important to us because it was just up from slavery. There was a lot of misunderstanding going, and we had to overcome a lot.
And there was a particular passion Carl had that would prove critical to the family story.
And my father especially wanted to do something about housing, because people leaving the Deep South and running from slavery needed somewhere to live. And he happened to be in Chicago and would go to the train station to help ex-slaves find housing.
Housing for Black people during this time came at a premium for two reasons. The first is that Chicago's Black population kept growing. Between 1909 and 1934, the city's Black population exploded from 44,000 to more than 230,000 residents. The second is because of something called restrictive housing covenants, written agreements between neighbors about who they'd sell their homes to based on race. And because of restrictive housing covenants, there were only a couple of neighborhoods in the entire city where Black people were allowed to purchase housing. Most Black Chicagoans, including the Hansberrys, lived in a part of town known as the Black Belt, a stretch of land that borders 29th Street on the north, 47th Street on the south, Cottage Grove on the east, and Wentworth on the west. Today, that same stretch of land is home to roughly 35,000 residents. But in the early 20th century, because of restrictive housing, it was home to hundreds of thousands of Black Chicagoans. So for decades, Chicago's booming Black population was made to live crowded on top of one another in one really tiny neighborhood because there was simply no place else for them to go. So being able to find nice places for Black people to live when they came to the area was a real skill. And Carl, as Mamie recalls, was quite adept at it.
Well, he worked in a bank as a, the word won't come to me, accountant. That's it. And he met a very well-to-do gentleman, white gentleman, who was going through this depression time. And he, in conversation, he told my father, I can't collect my rents. And my father said to him, I can collect your rents for you. And that struck up a friendship between the two. And Dad was indeed able to collect the rent for him. And that one thing led to another. And soon Dad had enough money to buy his own property and turned it into what is known as a kitchenette to make more room for more tenants.
Because Carl was so good at identifying properties he could convert and rent out to newly arrived Black residents, he became wealthy. Extremely wealthy. So wealthy that just about every article I could find about Carl noted his success in real estate and that that success provided his family with an extremely comfortable lifestyle. I asked Tay how Chicago's political establishment felt about having her great-grandfather, a Black man, having so much money.
I think maybe if he had been sort of a person who collected his wealth, lived in his wealth, and was quiet, he might have been more liked by whatever establishment we are speaking of. But he was not a quiet person, and he was about helping Black people.
Carl had a reputation around the city for not only having money, but for using his money to challenge the city's white establishment and advocate for African-American advancement. Tay's previously told the story of Carl throwing a private prom featuring Duke Ellington for Mamie and her classmates when her school announced that the Black students wouldn't be allowed to attend the official prom. And during our interview, she spoke of her great-grandfather taking the family to eat at some of the city's finest whites-only restaurants or demanding to be waited on in whites-only department stores. Her great aunt Lorraine had similar recollections of her father in several articles I found that focused on her childhood. But few acts would show Carl's commitment to the struggle for equality more than when he and his wife Nanny dared to leave the Black Belt. In 1937, with the help of several of his white real estate connections and his friends at the Supreme Life Insurance Company, the Hansberrys secretly purchased a 3-flat in Woodlawn, which, at the time, was an all-white neighborhood next to the University of Chicago. Mamie says that when she and her family moved into their new home, they received a venomous response from their white neighbors.
We were snubbed. And then suddenly there was a brick or a piece of mortar through our window, barely missing Lorraine's head. The love seat was on the right-hand side of the room and just missed her by bits, which infuriated us and frightened us.
Mamie's sister Lorraine was only 8 years old when the family moved to Woodlawn, but the hatred her family experienced when they came to the area was seared in her brain for life. In 1964, she penned an op-ed in the New York Times where she discussed the rock coming through the window towards her head and recalled her desperate and courageous mother patrolling the family's home all hours of night with a loaded gun, doggedly guarding her four children against white mobs. Mamie remembers Lorraine as an excellent listener who was skilled in absorbing the world around her. And many people have described her play, A Raisin in the Sun, as being loosely based on her family's own experience with integration, since the play centers on the story of a Black family who has the money to move out of Chicago's Black Belt, but is met with resistance from their would-be white neighbors. But the Hansberrys' own story has some notable differences from the play, including the way things would end. Not long after the Hansberrys moved to Woodlawn, several neighbors, including Anna M. Lee, sued, saying the neighborhood's restrictive housing covenant made the Hansberrys' presence in the area illegal. The Circuit Court of Cook County sided with Lee, saying a previous case ruled restrictive housing covenants were legally binding and were, therefore, grounds for the Hansberrys to be evicted. Carl Hansberry appealed the decision to the Illinois Supreme Court, which also sided with Lee. Then Carl appealed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1940, 3 years after the Hansberrys bought their home, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Carl's favor, saying the Hansberrys' interests weren't adequately represented by the previous restrictive housing covenant case, so the ruling couldn't be grounds for them to be evicted. Although the case didn't end restrictive housing covenants altogether, that would come 8 years later with Shelley v. Kramer. It certainly spelled the beginning of the end, as the ruling allowed the Hansberries to keep their Woodlawn home and opened up 500 more homes in the city's Woodlawn neighborhood to Black residents. The Hansberries were elated, but the victory, coupled with their other pushes towards more equity for the city's Black residents, made Chicago's white political class furious. Tay said that even though her great-grandparents won their day in court, they decided not to live in their Woodlawn home, citing concerns to their safety. She said they also began to face escalating harassment from the city.
So, you know, after all of that, because they had vacationed, imagine a Black family vacationing every winter in Mexico in the 1940s and 50s, he decided that he wanted to go live elsewhere, you know, because racism was exhausting. So he went to Mexico where, you know, he was the family. He bought a home in Mexico and then died shortly after of a cerebral hemorrhage, leaving the business and everything, you know, in the hands of his children.
Carl Hansberry died of a cerebral brain hemorrhage in 1946. He was only 50 years old. Carl's death at such a young age caught everyone off guard, but Tay and Mamie said he trained his children on how to manage his business many years earlier, so when he died, they'd be able to keep it running. And for several years, the family says everything with the real estate business ran smoothly. Then in 1955, Richard J. Daley was elected mayor of Chicago.
Mayor Daley was, you know, completely against, I mean, completely against my great-grandfather.
Tay and Mamie said that in the mid-1950s, the family began to see a resurgence of the harassment that Carl had experienced at the hands of the city.
You know, this is speculation, but once it was understood that, you know, the, because the head of the family was gone did not mean the family was gone, you know, that is when, you know, the hammer started to really come down.
I asked if they could cite specific instances or conversations that happened to make them believe a family was being targeted.
You know, there was a point where I believe they had $200,000 of code violations on one building. This is in the 50s. So
it was a Greek
tragedy
that we did bought a lot of property with. And he just simply told us that a judge friend of mine said the city of Chicago is going to come down on you.
Court documents indicate several Hansberry family members did try to sue the city and Mayor Daley for $1 million in the 1950s for essentially trying to steal the buildings from them. But after being fined and fined out of the family fortune, Mamie recalled the day she said Chicago police ran her out of town.
They surrounded our Hyde Park property, and what they didn't know was that some of our tenants were policemen, and they kept us informed. And but it was a little much for me, and I called my daughter's father in California, and I said, well, we're out of here.
Mamie says she was going to be arrested for non-payment of fines and fees on her buildings, so she and her brothers fled the city, leaving everything behind. Tay and Mamie say that's when the city claimed eminent domain over all the Hansberry properties and began to sell the family's real estate off at auction. And for more than six decades, that's where the family thought the story of their time in Chicago had ended. But then in 2021, Tay made another discovery.
I understood from a lawyer that I am, because I was thinking about maybe buying property in Chicago, that when the city confiscated, I was thinking about buying properties that were being auctioned in Chicago. So this is, you know, just the universe that kind of brought this to my attention. Once, you know, a property is auctioned off, apparently the money that's, you know, had from that sale is supposed to go back to the owner. And again, that really sparked, I really started going, wait a second, hold on a second. I've been hearing about properties auctioned off my whole life. I don't think that.
Tay and Mamie said the city never returned any of the money, and that to this day, they haven't seen a dime. As we were wrapping up the interview, I asked Tay and Mamie what they thought it meant that the city was willing to name a high school after them, but had never been willing to return their money. They said they thought it was wonderful that Hansberry Prep had been named for Lorraine. They also said they'd been invited back to Chicago by former Mayor Richard M. Daley to honor Lorraine, and that they found him to be quite kind. They even said that they weren't even sure if the current administration had any idea that this had ever happened to their family. They also said that none of that changes the fact that this did happen, and that there's still time for Chicago to make things right, if that's something Chicago was truly interested in doing. Lastly, I asked Tay what it would mean to take a check from the city of Chicago and put it back in her 100-year-old grandmother's hands.
It would mean everything. It would mean that, you know, it would be.
Has not been in vain.
She decided to answer it for me. granddaughter to granddaughter, you understand.
Sylvia Snowden, WGN News, Chicago.